with this Dream Chaser, and this thing looks like a small space shuttle. It's about 25% the size. Once it has a crew, after many flights of bringing cargo to the space station, eventually they're going to develop one with a crew. That thing will be able to carry up to 7 people and up to a space station and down. But now, we'll be able to see this thing launch on an Atlas V rocket, encapsulated in a fairing, so you won't see the vehicle itself. It'll look like a regular rocket. But once it goes up, the fairing disappear, and you're going to have this thing that looks like a small space shuttle. It's got wings and everything. Let me drop it. After docking with the space station in the beginning of crew vehicle, they'll be able to unload. They're talking about 12,000 pounds worth of stuff. This is like over 2 times the amount of stuff that we can do now with the Russians and with SpaceX. So it's going to be able to bring a lot of weight up to the International Space Station, also back, because they bring a lot of science equipment back. And this thing's going to deorbit, and it's going to come back, no parachute. It's going to come back to the spacecraft. And the first flights are going to actually land on the runway, one of the same runways that Space Shuttle used to land down in Florida. And of course, they'll have a backup in California and White Sands, Mexico. But after that, they'll be able to actually land in any airport they wanted to. They would have that capability. Back to you, WS1.
Any further questions on all of the above, Nick?
No, I'm
that's
good.
Boston,
thank you for
2019.
For all that info. Something to think about. Back to you, Dick. This is N2HVR.
Okay, and I was going to say real quick, that starts 2019, maybe 2020. There's always delays, so I'll go with 2020. Back to you.
Let's see if K has come back. AC2LR, K2RIW, have you had a chance to put the PL back on your rig? Go ahead, K, K2RIW listening.
It was my battery that died. Can you hear me? This is AC2LR.
We're hearing you very well. Glad you had a spare battery. Go right ahead, K.
I actually don't have a spare battery. I've just been charging for the last 5 minutes.
So I guess you're saying you've got to keep your print transmissions brief. So maybe you can squeeze in your question. Give it a try. AC2LR, K2RIW. Batteries can be a real pain. When I was watching the news report tonight of what's going on in the Houston area because of Hurricane Hardy, I can't think of the name of the hurricane. A number of people didn't realize how fast the water was rising into their house, so they went to higher and higher floors, and eventually some of those people were in the attic of the house on the cell phone saying, you've got to rescue me because the water is coming up to where I am and I have no way to get out. And then the cell phone battery went dead. Can you imagine being in the attic of the house, the water is rising below you, you're trapped, and your cell phone don't have a way of talking to the outside world. I remember, I guess it was in Hurricane Katrina, there were people in that situation, which in some cases they used a axe that was in their hand, a hand axe, to chop a hole in the roof so they could get out onto the roof of the house so they wouldn't be drowned inside the house as the water was rising. That strikes me as a very uncomfortable situation. You got to think ahead when you're going to higher floors in the house. Make sure you don't go beyond the floor where you can walk out a window, so to speak. Anybody have any further questions or comments on everything they've heard tonight? Give me a call later tonight. Right now. K2RIW listening.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I did see that on the news. Probably CNN. I watch that a lot. And they had a hole right through the roof, as they were going up and down the boat, with a boat going through this one town or area. They did say people were doing that. Stop right through the roof. The place was pretty much abandoned, but they did find some people, some elderly people, and they got on to the CNN boat. I mean, it's going to be going on for quite a few days. They're going to get a lot more rain. So, yeah, you don't want to get trapped on the roof or in the roof. On the roof is better, but then they said some people heard the tornado sirens going. Now, what do? You know, that's a double whammy. But they got a lot of problems down there. I did see quite a bit of that. Back to you, Dick.
One of the things that was repeated quite often on the news was this guy with a great big white SUV truck, and he had all his possessions in the back of the truck, you could tell. And because he's got this very high, big vehicle, he seemed to have the attitude he could go through anything. And he went into water that was starting to go, you know, a major highway that was going under a bridge, and therefore it was dipping down, and the water was coming up above the hood of the car, of the truck, and pretty soon, of course, the engine drowned out, and the vehicle was starting to float. Lucky for us, lucky for him, he was smart enough to crank down the window and swim out the window, because his chance of opening the door on that vehicle with water on the outside was zero. Arnold Schwarzenegger wouldn't be able to open that door. And when he climbed out the window and jumped down outside, the water was deeper than his altitude, if you know what I mean. He went underwater trying to get his feet down to the ground when he jumped out the window of his vehicle. The fact that he saw the water coming up and he thought his vehicle could go through anything and he kept going forward was the real mistake. Very foolish. Sometimes I see these people, see these people driving at very high speeds through water that's, let's say, 3 feet deep. They don't realize that if any of that water splashes up and gets into the carburetor of the car, it's over, because your pistons cannot compress water. So whenever you're driving through water, you gotta drive slow. Water splashing up fast, if it gets into the carburetor, you're in trouble. It can easily drown out your ignition system. So there's an awful lot of lessons to be learned, and they're being learned. The last I heard, two people had already perished in the Houston area, and I suspect there's going to be more. And with any further comments on what the news tonight has shown, I haven't seen the news in the last 5 hours. K2RIW listening.
Yeah, WS2N.
You've got a pull.
Yeah, I'm waiting to see how the infrastructure held out with the all the refineries and everything they got down there. I spent some time down in Texas City, this place that I was just talking about where CNN was floating their boat through, like a suburb of Texas City. That's a long strip of Texas City, and it's for miles and miles. As far as you can go, it's nothing but, industrial piping, many, many, many stories high, and tanks. I'm just wondering how that stuff survived. That one place, Rock, is it Rock? Not Rock, but Rock something or other. They get a direct hit. I mean, they're talking about people not coming back for like months on end. They got hit with the wind. So one lady there with a house demolished, and she's standing there with a generator running. I mean, what's the point? I mean, it's time to leave. Back to you, sir.
Yes, from time to time they say that this is a 500-year event, the amount of water. Wow. It's certainly significant. It looks like it's going to be not quite as bad as Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. There was an awful lot of people who perished. In this case, a good percentage of the people listened to the suggestion for evacuation. And I think right now there's a big discussion as to whether or not the mayor of Houston should have made it a law that you had to evacuate. That's a tough one, because Murphy's Law dictates had he made it a law, it would have been a minor event, and he'd be considered a bad guy for overreacting. It's a very difficult situation like that to come up with the right answer. when you don't know ahead of time exactly how bad it's going to be. Anyone have any further questions, comments on any of the above, give me a call. That is right now. K2RIW in the tech net.
KM4KPV.
Go right ahead, David. Lucky for you, Lexington. I'd like to believe Lexington doesn't get weather quite that bad. So I bet you've had some tornadoes in the past years. You've got it, David.
Roger that. We don't get hurricanes, but the Ohio River will flood. And we had that whole series of tornado outbreaks, in particular the most famous being in 1974. I remember flying in. I grew up on Long Island, actually, and I was born here, but I remember flying in to visit my grandparents, flew into Louisville, and it looked like somebody taking a giant lawnmower and just made strips through the city. But in regards to what's happening in Texas, the night before, I was listening to WX Talk, which was a net being operated in conjunction with the National Hurricane Center. I was listening to EchoLink, and I became aware that they were using a combination of EchoLink and an All-Star for voice over IP. And I was wondering if you guys know what the difference between All-Star and EchoLink is, and what's the advantage of using All-Star versus EchoLink, or vice versa. Back to you.
If Eric is available, he might know the difference between All-Star and EchoLink. KE2EJ, if you're there, K2RIW. Go ahead, Eric. Is anyone else within the sound of my voice familiar with something that's EchoLink-like, which is called All-Star? Anyone else familiar with it? Give me your call letters right now. So from your knowledge, David, is All-Star something that's used in your neighborhood that has EchoLink-like characteristics? How have you become familiar with All-Star? KM4KPV, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
K2RIW. Dick, I became aware of it some time ago, and I noticed when I was monitoring the National Hurricane Center, communicating with all these folks, that quite widely used to link all these repeaters all through the Southwest up into Tennessee, and it's also used for north in Ohio and Indiana. Here in Kentucky, we practice ARIES and that's like everybody else, and pretty much we do a statewide once a week link through IRLP. And at coffee last Saturday, where we all gathered, I was telling these folks about this, and I said, you know, we should really be looking at some alternatives, because I was really impressed with how efficient this was going. I mean, they had a net control operator in Illinois, one in Delaware, so they're not directly affected, and they were getting real-time reports, and at one point, the director of the National Hurricane Center came on to query one person down, not in Rockport, which was the direct hit, but right next door, to get their ground wind speed. And I was just really impressed the way it worked.
Have you ever Googled the word All-Star? I wonder if you could possibly get some information that way, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, Dick, I did, and I actually found they have a website. It's a .org website. It appears the biggest difference is it has the ability to interface with trunk systems, and so it appears that you would be able to more readily interface ham operators with fire departments, police departments, and so on, whereas EchoLink doesn't appear to have that ability. And I just thought perhaps...
K2UPS.
Back to you, Ned.
There's a chance we've got somebody on frequency who's got some smarts on this one. Rich, K2 Uncle Papa Sierra, in Pennsylvania, K2LIW. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick, now I just did a quick Google search. I typed in Allstar versus Echolink, and there are several websites that compare the two. I didn't take the time to read them, but it is there. You just put in that phrase, Allstar versus Echolink, and it'll bring you up line by line what one can do that the other one can't, what the similarity are, whatever. That's all there. And I was out of the truck for a while, too, so I don't know if you discussed anything about the eclipse and the propagation or not, but I was off Echolink for a little bit. Back to you.
Yeah, the conclusion we've come to so far, by way of the reverse beacons and the ARRL website, is that the amount of impact that eclipse has on HF propagation does not appear to be huge. And one of the things that we were discussing earlier is we got asked the question of whether or not the AM broadcast stations that are supposed to go off the air at nighttime or go down to low power at nighttime because of longer range propagation without the D-layer, were any of those stations required to go to low power or go off the air during the eclipse? And the answer was no, because once again, the real dark area of the eclipse is a 75-mile diameter circle, which only dwells for a few minutes in any one spot. So the total impact on a hemisphere of ionosphere is very small from this tiny little shadow from the moon, so to speak. So that's one of the conclusions we came to. Well, if you've got any further questions on all of the above, Rich, K2UPS, mobile, K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2UPS, I did hear the question and the answer about the AM broadcast. It's interesting. But my personal, well, two observations, one from a friend of mine who lived in Alaska and was operating 40-meter whisper, which is the propagation mode. And prior to totality, he had a few hits, a few people were hearing him. During the eclipse, particularly totality, he had a huge number of hits on 40 meters. As soon as the eclipse was over, 40 meters dropped out again. Now, my experience using 20-meter CW on Long Island, when I was driving Dixville to the lighthouse prior to the start of the eclipse here, and granted 70% or so, we were making contacts all over the U.S. and it's 20-meter CW. I get down to the beach just about when it was going to start, and I thought, what changed? But 20 meters just dropped out. It wasn't that I wasn't hearing signal. I was hearing signals, but nobody was listening. And you mentioned the reverse beacon network. There was a lot of stations, cool, very, very many stations running fairly fast, but maybe 25 words a minute or higher speed CW, calling CQ, SEQ for the solar eclipse QSO party, but they weren't pausing between their next CQ. You could barely get like K2 in there, and they would just immediately call CQ again. They weren't listening. They were all looking at the eclipse, and they were monitoring the reverse beacon network. And that kind of ticked me off, because if you want to participate in the QSO party, you should be trying to talk to people and get signal reports. If all you want to do is get a computer to tell you what you're doing, then get on whisper mode. But to tie up the bands like that and use memory keys, that really turned me off. But I did see a drop in propagation, though, on 20 meters during the eclipse here, and it picked up again after the eclipse was over.
Quite interesting. That friend of yours that during the eclipse all of a sudden had a whole lot of people to talk to, where was he located with reference to where the eclipse was at that time? Over to you, Rich, K2UPS, K2RIW.
He was in Nebraska. I forget the exact town. I believe he was covered in a total pass. And he wasn't talking to people. He was beaconing on whisper using very low power digital mode, and you could then monitor the computer and see who heard you, how high above the noise floor you were, that sort of thing. So it's great for propagation, predicting and actually seeing what it's doing. But my complaint was that people were doing that in a regular part of the band using CW, you know, calling CQ like they want to talk to people, but yet nobody's listening on the other end. And all they were doing was monitoring the reverse beacon network. But he saw an increase in 40 meters during the eclipse, and I saw a decrease in 20 meters during the eclipse.
Which sounds like the opposite, which is a little bit mysterious. Give me a few words on what is Whisper. Is it all like any of the other WSJT modes? What is Whisper, Rich? KTUPS, K2RIW?
I haven't done it myself, but I believe it was Joe Taylor is involved in it, but it's weak. It stands for Weak Signal Propagation Reporting. And it's basically you set up a little, you can build either a little tiny single frequency transmitter, because it's not a transceiver, and hook it up to a wire in your backyard. Some guys use magnetic loops, whatever, but they run on literally flea power. Many guys are running far less than 1 watt. Although you can run a watt or two if you want, but it's just really, really low power, and this thing just runs 24 hours a day, or whenever you turn it on, and it's basically beaconing your position. And other stations are listening on specific frequencies for all of these beacons, and it may report into the internet and to a web page what they've heard, who they've heard. So you can bring up a map and see, well, gee, I just heard Germany. I just heard Japan. Well, my signal from my QPH is being heard in Germany or Japan. But you're not actually working them because it's not two-way. It's only one way. So it's great for propagation predictions, like I said, but the other way to do it is what these guys were doing on CW, calling CQ and then looking on the reverse beacon network. But to me, that kind of took some of the fun out of the QSO party.
Is there a very exact frequency that Whisper is done? Is there a frequency on 20 meters, a frequency on 15 meters, and so on? K2UPS, K2RIW?
I believe so. If it isn't a specific frequency, it's a small range of frequencies. I've never set one up myself. I haven't delved that much into it. I know some of my friends monitor it. Sometimes I do look at the website. I think it's WSPRReporter.com. I think that's what it is. Before I go out portable to see what bands are currently good in real time. But I haven't, I don't monitor any of those frequencies myself.
Good information, and I thank you, Rich. Okay, one last call. Anyone have any further questions or comments on all of the above? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet. There being none, we'll say 73 for now. See you guys next week. Be kind to each other. If you're curious, go to amateurradio.tangovictor, and you can play back the Irish Wake of KC2WGB. All 8 hours of it are there, recorded by AC2GS Roy, the guy who was the net control from 9 p.m. last Friday night, a week ago, until 5 o'clock in the morning, 8 hours later. So that Irish Wake, as he calls it, for John, KC2WGB, lasted a total of 8 continuous hours. 25 or 26 people signed in and all told tall stories, honest stories about what their interception, what their encounter with John was like. Bye-bye, you all. I'm going to turn it over to Paul. He wants to tie the ribbons on it. WS2N for any finals. K2RIW clear but listening. You got it, Paul. See you next week.
Okay, very good. And one thing I didn't mention, I wanted to ask if you saw the documentary about Voyager on Channel 13 a couple of days ago. It was on for about an hour and a half. Very well done, from beginning to end. Did you see that thing?
Not only did I see it, I think it is a 2-hour show, and I only only saw it from beginning to end twice. Very well done. Back to you, Paul. KQLIW.
Yeah, it was just over an hour and a half, and then they filled in the last 20 minutes with Colin Porco and some information about, I believe, Cassini and some other information. So, yeah, that's what they did there.
Yeah, the total show was 2 hours, but you're right. The only Voyager portion was hour and a half. And that spacecraft, Voyager, is the best proof I have. And any time I'm giving a talk on the subject of radio, and somebody asks me, I'm using a so-and-so transmitter, what's the range? And my answer almost always is, the range is infinity. You launch a radio signal from any antenna on any frequency, it goes to every single cubic centimeter of this universe. Every radio signal ever emitted goes everywhere. The signal never stops. As you get further and further away in the direction where there's a partial null in the antenna pattern, the signal gets very weak very fast, but it never goes to zero. Use the right equipment. In the case of Voyager, 12 billion miles, 120 astronomical units. Let me drop it. 3 times the distance to Pluto. Something like a 6-watt transmitter. 40 years later, essentially every day is still talking to us. An amazing piece of hardware. But in order to get that signal, you have to use some really big receiving dishes on the Earth, state-of-the-art low-noise amplifiers, very narrow bandwidth, 50 hertz data rate, 50 bits per second. But as long as you're willing to do that, slow down the data, narrow up the antenna pattern, use the best possible antennas, there's no limit. I think you told me, Paul, that right now the current funding is at least to listen part of the time to Voyager out to the year 2022. And I have good reason to believe they will still be talking to it in the year 2022. I think you told me that, though, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, it's 2024, but there are some predictions that it might go longer. Some guys think, well, maybe it's going to go to 2034, another 10 years longer than the predicted date, but we'll see. And that show, they talk about Voyager as it's one, sometimes as if it's only one spacecraft. Especially toward the end, you know. I mean, it really is two different spacecraft. They did a great job. You know, they really. If I knew I was going to be on, I would have made an announcement on the net, because we talk about Voyager so many times on the net over the years. You know, as far as I know, it was called the farthest, and it said Voyager space. That's what came up on my back to you, sir.
The thing that they should have said in that program is that the 12-foot dish at 8.5 gigahertz has a beamwidth of something like 8/10 of a degree, if I did the calculation correct. So you've got a whole, you've got the 45 dB or something like that, dB of gain in that antenna that boosts that 6-watt signal up to something really that you can listen to. That's the good news. The bad news is that very thin pencil beam antenna. If it's not aimed precisely at Earth, you get nothing. So 40 years later, the positioning system of those reaction control jets and or inertial wheels, whatever it uses, 40 years later, can still keep that spacecraft plus or minus 3/10 of a degree aimed at the Earth in azimuth and elevation. That is one hell of an accomplishment. I wish I knew whether or not they're doing it with reaction control jets and the fuel lasted 40 years, or inertial wheels that haven't worn out. How in the world have they done that, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
They call it dead band reckoning. Somehow it's just positioned in one spot and they never have to really adjust it. I mean, it's so little of an adjustment at that kind of an angle. I guess once in a while they do, and they probably, I know there is hydrazine fuel on board, and I suspect they they will have to use that once in a while. You know, fuel, they, not that show, there was, you know, other articles I read that fuel is a problem. The problem is keeping the radio alive using the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generator system. And, you know, are the thermocouples going to burn themselves out or, you know, not burn themselves out, but, you know, stop it working with one another. And that's what they think is going to fail. The radioactivity will keep going. So some kind of dead, they call it dead band reckoning. I've looked it up before. You could always read about that. It's an actual thing that they use.
I am guessing the spacecraft is spinning like a gyroscope. It's spinning with the axis of rotation being the bore site of the antenna. Is somebody transmitting?
Yeah, I just said no spinning. It's not spinning.
You sure it's not spinning?
Yeah, that's why they call it dead band reckoning. So you got to Google that, and maybe you can understand it better than me. Back here.
How do you know it is not spinning, Paul?
I've read it many times, and then once you read it, you read how they're controlling the spacecraft, and they talk about the high-bensine jets and all the you know, whatever systems that they used when they went past all the planets. And then they talk about dead band reckoning system, and they say that the spacecraft is not spinning. It's in one position. It's not spinning. It's not like Juno going around Jupiter now. That definitely is spinning three times a minute. This is straight ahead. It's strange.
D2IS, come in.
Go right ahead, Bill.
My understanding about Voyager is that, yes, it points its antenna straight at Earth. And I guess early on in its launch, it might have rotated about the axis of that antenna. The antenna would remain pointed at Earth. But I think later on, that was just maybe during certain maneuvers it would do that. But later on, it would stay fixed, not rotating, pointing at Earth. However, if it lost contact with Earth, if it lost the signal from Earth, it would initiate a roll where the antenna would sweep all around, and it would be looking to reacquire signal. And then when it reacquired signal, it would stop that rotation. AC2IS.
Amazing. I know that once the platform that steers the telescopes had its jamming phenomena, I know they had to use some other techniques at times to steer the whole spacecraft during a flyby to capture all the things they wanted to capture. And so if they were doing that during a non-spin, that's a much more simple maneuver. So because of those maneuver requirements, maybe that's when they stopped the spinning and never reestablished it. Amazing. I'm still having great trouble that they haven't run out of reaction control jet gas. And we've never heard any words on the subject of little tunable paddles on the side that you can adjust so that the solar wind will push it just right. Or we've never heard about, which is something they've used on later spacecraft, and we never heard anything about inertial wheels on Voyager. WS2N for any other comments, K2LAW.
Yeah, I think they have them, but they just don't use them that often. So, and then, like the other fellow was saying, like when they moved the spacecraft a couple of times when they were checking to see if it left the heliopause, they actually moved the spacecraft, and then it moved back to find its point back to Earth. But the sun and the Earth are so relatively close to one another that there's some kind of sun sensor or star sensor type of thing behind the 12-foot dish. There's a hole in the middle of the dish, and the sense that it looks through that hole. It looks for the light of the sun. So, I don't know. There's a lot to it. It was Channel 13. They tell you, I thought a lot of information, but they're not going to get that technical, unfortunately, back either.
Because they are 120 astronomical units out, when the Earth is at the maximum angle away from the sun, 120 astronomical units and one astronomical unit is only a subtended angle of 3 degrees. In other words, worst case, the sun is never more than 3 degrees away from the Earth. So, if all else fails, and you aim the dish at the sun, you're never more than 3 degrees away from aiming at the Earth. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's right. That's more or less what I've read over the years. Of course, that was not on the documentary. But they did good. Toward the end, they talked about the record a lot. And they talked about Voyager having this chance of, reaching an intelligent species somewhere. But the way they talked about it, as if it was one spacecraft. What they should have really said at the end is, there's two spacecrafts, so we have twice, two times, one's going to go one way and the other one's going the other way, it's not one chance, it's two chances of contacting somebody. I know the odds are really, really way out there, though. Back to you, sir.
As a number of people have said, the 55 voices saying hello, 55 different languages, the photographs, all of us trying to tell some extraterrestrial intelligence what the Earth is like. The major benefit we get out of that was for us, not for them. The chances of them picking that up is very slim in any reasonable length of time. But it gives us a more galactic view of our place in the universe as I see it. The fact that we issued that record. And it's kind of amazing that Carl Sagan had used a whole lot of political muscle to force NASA to take a photograph of the Earth, to look back and look at that tiny little dot of Earth, which is less than one pixel in the high-gain telescope. But it's awful good that they did that. But they did want to do it. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, because there was officially no science involved in that. I think there is, because it inspires, younger people, and, maybe they'll go into science. So, indirectly, it is feeding the science community by doing something like that. But there's two other spacecraft. There's the Pioneer spacecraft, Pioneer 10 and 11, and they're also going off in different trajectories. Of course, they're not communicating with Earth anymore. Those things failed a long time ago. But they do. Each one does have a plaque on board, and doesn't have a record. But those two have plaques on it, so we really got four chances. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, did Pioneer 10 and 11, did they have a RTG? And I'm also amazed that 40 years downrange, the filament on the traveling wave tube of each of those transmitters is still functioning. That is amazing. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, whoever made those tubes, I'm not talking about the company, but whoever actually made them. It was the guy that actually pulled it out of the kiln or whatever it was, whatever they had to do to make that thing. They all deserve a raise, but they're probably all retired right now. And yes, Pioneers had RTGs as well. Back then, everything that the Viking landers that landed on Mars had RTGs. Ulysses spacecraft that went around the sun on a polar orbit around the north. South Pole of the Sun, RTGs, Cassini, which is going to dive into the Cassini, it's going to dive into the Saturn atmosphere next month. That has an RTG. Galileo had an RTG. That was the one in orbit around Jupiter. But we don't have any nuclear threats, so nobody's making this stuff anymore. They offer it, not in a large quantity. Back to you.
Aren't we running very low on plutonium that we can use to make RTGs? Isn't there a problem that future spacecraft, multiple spacecraft, are all going to be vying for the exact same chunk of plutonium to make RTGs and pull ahead?
Yes, they are. You know, Mars Curiosity has it. The other two didn't have it there. They have the solar panel, Spirit and Opportunity. But the new 2020 Mars rover, that's going to have it. But there's very little left. I don't know. Some amount of pounds we're talking about. It's very little. I think each one has, each spacecraft has like 9 pounds of the stuff. I think there's like, you know, maybe a stockpile of 80 pounds or something left. And as we talk, as the years go by, that stockpile is actually getting lower and lower because it has a half-life of 80-some-odd years. So we're going to run out, and that's going to be it. But they are making, John, John Beck, he said that they're making it out in Oregon someplace. So maybe they'll have some more someday. Back to you.
Because of the SALT agreements, Strategic Arms Limitation Talk agreements, a whole lot of nuclear weapons were decommissioned. I think each nuclear weapon contains a certain amount of plutonium. So if we capture all of those chunks of plutonium, shouldn't that be useful for RTGs of the bulk?
From what I understand, the nuclear source in all those bombs are not—it's not the same stuff, and it doesn't have any of it in the process of making that before they put them on all these warheads. The residue of that process is what they were saving, and that was plutonium-239, and that's what they used.
Are you saying that the weapons don't contain any plutonium-239?
I gotta get my numbers right, but I believe that's it. We'll have to check. Whatever it is, I think they have 238 in the, you know, the net of nukes, but 239 is a byproduct of the process of making it, and that's why we have this stuff. And they put that in the RTG.
Do you know the half life of 238 versus the half life of 239, Paul?
I just know 239 is 80 some odd years. I forgot the half life of 239, but we can find that real quick on a computer. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. The clock is going. Back to you, Dick, and I'm going to say 73.
I already did. Bye bye, Paul. See you next week. Be well.
Right back to you. 73. Everybody else on the net as well. WS2N.
Time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. Net tonight at 8:30 W2VL Repeater System.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Thank you. tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater.
WB2ZOC. KMV from WB2ZOC.
Still folds down on these things. Got to take a bunch of bolts out, but you can still do that. got a guy from New Jersey just ripped by me on a motorcycle, weaving in and out of traffic, which is getting heavier and heavier over here.
Unfortunately, I predict a short life for him. I see guys like that all the time. You don't see many old guys on bikes doing that, and I think there's a reason. They don't survive that long.
Must have been doing like 80, weaving in and out of traffic over by Greenpoint.
Yeah, I see that a lot. That's just nasty. Very foolish, but what can you do? I got to try to work on some RFI issues in this Jeep, too, when I'm home this week. When I'm running the 100-watt amplifier, it's getting into the computer or the stuff. I ordered an RF choke. I put that at the base of the antenna. Figured that would give me some relief. Actually, it almost seemed to make it worse. So I got to put an analyzer on it. I mean, I know I have the antenna tuned for lowest SWR, for the CW part of the band, but I still need to put an analyzer on it, check that, and do some other stuff, maybe reroute some of the wires in here. It was happening even when I ran the amp and the radio on separate batteries, not plugged into the Jeep, still happening. But I got to locate the computers, try wrapping them in foil. That helps too. But Jeeps are not known for being RF hardened.
Yeah. Hey, I wonder what would happen if you put the choke on the cables coming into the computer.
Well, that's a possibility, too. You know, and I'm assuming that's what I'm getting into, because all I know is if I raise the power above 25 watts on 20 meters or 40 watts on 40 meters, all the idiot lights come on, the gauges go to zero, the engine fan comes on, it stays on, the air conditioner will not function, or it's not cooling the air anymore. I think it shuts the compressor down. The blower keeps going, and it increases speed when I key up. Lots of fun stuff.
You gotta love it.
The only one that scares me is the airbag tape. If that sensor's coming up, I don't want to be able to trip it via RF, you know? That would not be fun, face planting into the airbag as I'm going down the road.
Definitely not a good thing.
Well, a good thing, though, being that it's a manual transmission, even when I'm going down the interstate at 60 miles an hour, whatever, I can shut it off and then start it up again while I'm still rolling to clear it out. That clears out most of them. The check engine light stays on for about 50 miles, and that eventually goes out. But, you know, if I have to clear the other stuff, we'll get the AC going again. I just have to start it, restart it. Couldn't do that with an automatic.
I got a guy in front of me, small van with California commercial plates on it. He just straight across the Tiger Stretch and cuts in front of me. He wouldn't get away with that in California, I tell you.